All right, I'm going to invite your attention this evening to the book of Esther in chapter number 1. Esther chapter 1 says, "Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, or King Xerxes." This is Ahasuerus, which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia over 127 provinces. That in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the palace, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces being before him. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days, even in 84 days, and when these days were expired, the king made a feast unto all the people that were present in Shushan the palace, both unto great and small, 7 in the court of the garden of the king's palace, where were white, green, and blue hangings, fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rings and pillars of marble. The beds were of gold and silver, upon a pavement of red and blue and white and black and marble, and some translations have that as mother of pearl. And they gave them drink in vessels of gold, the vessels being diverse one from another, and royal wine in abundance, according to the state of the king. And the drinking was according to the law. None did compel, so the king had appointed to all the officers of his house that they should do according to every man's pleasure. Also Vashti, the queen, made a feast for the women in the royal house which belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, the 7 chamberlains that served in the presence of Ahasuerus the king, to bring Vashti the queen before the king with the crown royal, to show the people and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to look on. But the queen Vashti refused to come at the king's commandment by his chamberlains. Therefore was the king very wroth, and his anger burned in him. Let's just stop right there this evening, and we'll just see how time goes in this. The book of Esther, this wonderful book that I hope that we'll study together on Wednesday evenings. One of the most interesting facts of the book of Esther, as I pointed out to you a couple of weeks ago, is that the name of God is never mentioned anywhere in the book of Esther. Read it. I encourage you to read this book and refamiliarize yourself with the narrative of it. But the name of God is never mentioned anywhere in the entirety of the book of Esther. Yet we know that the hand of God is heavily at work throughout the book of Esther. In fact, it is interesting that the king's name, King Ahasuerus, or King Xerxes, same fella, King Ahasuerus, his name is mentioned some 150 times, give or take a few, in this book. But God's name is not mentioned in the book. But the truth about it is, when you read the book, you learn that King Ahasuerus is really not the man in charge after all. He thinks he is, but God is the King of Kings, who is in charge of all things. And in this book, it is noteworthy that the author doesn't begin with Esther, nor does he begin with Mordecai. The author is inspired to begin to tell us about this pagan Gentile king, this Medo-Persian, Media, emperor or ruler. It begins with telling us about him and his great wealth, riches, and power. And that's how this begins. It begins by showing the majesty and the supreme authority, we speak as mortals, the supreme authority of King Ahasuerus. Mentions throughout this first chapter just how wealthy. And I don't think any of us have any real appreciation. And the truth is, I don't know how we could ever have a real appreciation of how well off this king was, how powerful King Ahasuerus was. And the writer is setting him up as this man of tremendous power and wealth and glory. Yet at the same time, we're going to get introduced to a few things that maybe he's not everything he thinks he is. Maybe doesn't have as much power as he believes he has. But we read immediately that he is the king from India to Ethiopia, over 127 provinces. It's amazing, really, if you look at a current day map of the vastness of the Medo-Persian Empire, or the Persian Empire. Medo-Persian, Persian, same thing. It's amazing how far that this empire extended. All the way, we read in verse 1, from India even unto Ethiopia, which today, just think about this, today would cover Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, Syria, Jordan, Turkey, and even parts of Egypt. That's how vast this empire was. And when you look at it on a map, Israel's just this tiny little speck among all those other nations. And of course, he had control over Israel as well. It's simply really to us mind-boggling. This was, at this time, the most powerful man on the planet, King Ahasuerus. It would be hard to exaggerate his wealth, his fame, his fortune, and the vastness of his empire. It was huge, literally governed over millions of souls. Many years later, after what takes place here, Alexander the Great will go to war, destroy the Medo-Persian Empire. Alexander the Great will, well, 100 years after what we're reading right here. And when he enters into the palace, this Shushan, the palace, the winter palace here that where all these events take place, it is recorded, an old historian records, that he found 120 tons of gold in the palace. 120 tons of gold in the palace. That's just some idea of the vastness of the wealth of this empire. And this man, King Ahasuerus, reigns over this huge, vast empire, thousands upon thousands of governors, princes, nobles, all of these that would have been servant to him, served under him. And he throws this huge party. In fact, he throws a six-month-long party. 180 days, we read in verse number 4, in which he shows the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty. Many days, 180 days, or 6 months. He throws this party in Shushan the palace. The Medo-Persians had essentially four capitals of their empire, and one of them was here at Susa, or Shushan, same place. And this was where they held, where they would winter at. This is where they would go during the winter time to escape either freezing cold or summertime to escape the heat. This is where they would come in the wintertime. And here he spends some 6 months putting on a show. You need to understand some of this history, some of the backdrop of what's going on, is that Xerxes' father, King Ahasuerus, his father, Darius, I hope you pay attention here in your notes, his father, King Darius, had gone out and made war with the Greeks and lost. And it is Ahasuerus' goal to finish what his daddy started. His daddy started a war with the Greeks and was beat and pushed back. And so Ahasuerus, part of what this is, part of this six-month-long party, is not just him having a good old time, but throughout the entirety of this 6 months, princes and nobles and governors and rulers from this vast empire are funneled in through him. Of course, not all on one day. It would have taken some of them weeks or months to travel. So during this time, this 180-day long, drawn-out, look at me and how great I am party that he's having, part of it is for him to drum up support for the battle he's getting ready to go and wage against Greece. And I won't read all this. I read a lot of the some of the history behind this, and some of the things that he would tell people, and according to this old historian we have, this old historian was saying, listen, whoever has, he was sort of bribed these governors, nobles, princes, and said to them, when it's time for battle, whoever has the biggest, strongest, most well-trained army among your little ruler, among your little part, I will reward them greatly. And so he brings these people before him in this huge palace, phenomenal palace that was built, riches beyond measure, and he funnels noble and governor and prince and funnels these people for 6 months in front of them and tells them, we're going to have a war. I'm going out to war. I need your support. I need your financial support. I need your army. And those of you who are the most committed to be will be the most rewarded. And so it's easy to see as these people make their way in front of the king, they see all of his pomp, they see all of his power, they see his majesty, and they know that in his hand is life and death. In the hand of the king, there is life and death. And they know, number one, if I'm not faithful to him, he'll kill me in a heartbeat. And then besides that, they also know that if I do serve him well, I could be rewarded with riches beyond imagination. King Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, I'm talking about the same guy, don't get confused. I like saying Xerxes better than I like Ahasuerus, but the king, don't get the idea that he was some super sweet, great guy. He was not. He was a pagan, rotten king who enjoyed every pleasure of the flesh imaginable. It is said, again, by early historians, that he got so frustrated, and really you'll find out in between chapters 1 and 2, he wages war with Greece. We'll get into that in a little bit longer later, but during his campaign against Greece, he has a number of his soldiers are trying to build a bridge across this body of water. And because they don't build it fast enough, he has all of them beheaded. And the reason they didn't build it fast enough is there was a vast or huge storm that was slowing them down. But he didn't care. He got so mad at them anyway, had them all beheaded. So don't get the idea this is some great guy with, you know, some wonderful king. He's not. He's a pagan. He's lost. He's wicked. But he has immense power. But don't get the idea that he's outside of the control of God Almighty, because he's not. Even with all of his riches, he is but a pauper when compared to our king. Even with all of his vast army, he is a weakling compared to our king. With all of his great might and his prestige over the known world, he is nothing compared to our king. So anyway, I want you to try to get this idea of what he is. It's a parade of conquered foes and princes and nobles, those people that had been conquered by him. There was a rebellion in Babylon. He went and squashed that. There was a rebellion in Egypt. He went and squashed that. And he would bring these conquered foes before them and make them swear their allegiance to him. And what he entitled himself, what he called himself, was the King of all kings. That was what he called, Xerxes called himself. And for 6 months, this goes on. And that's what happens in verses 1 through 4. And notice with me, know in verse number 5, and when these days were expired, the king made a feast unto all the people that were present in Shushan, the palace, both of great and small. Under great and small. 7 days. So in other words, at the end of, and the best I think I have this, the best I think, the text relates this, is at the end of this big, long, elaborate 6-month party, a fundraising party, a showing off party, I want your allegiance party. At the end of that, I believe what we find is that he sort of rewards his staff. I don't want to, I don't want to call them employees because that would be way too generous for how they were treated or what they were thought of. But for those who lived in and worked in and dwelt in the palace, Shushan the palace proper, it is almost as if he gives a 7-day reward to them by throwing them a party as well. In fact, just look at what it says, that when these days were expired, when that 180 days, long drawn out, look at me, isn't this great Babylon that I've built? You know, that's what Nebuchadnezzar said. It's pretty much the same thing by Ahasuerus. At the end of these things, when these days were expired, the king made a feast unto all the people that were present in Shushan the palace, both great and small. In other words, it's not just this time princes and nobles and governors, but the lesser people, what the King James here calls the great and small, or what we would say, loosely, what we would say, the important people and the unimportant people. It's not just for VIPs anymore. This is not just for people with political clout, but now also those underlings, those who worked underneath him. And he holds a celebration for them. I really think, and I've got a little bit of backing behind some commentaries, that this is sort of a 7 days, you guys have spent the last 6 months putting on a party. Now let me just reward you a little bit for all that you've done for this 7 days. But it's not without him also continuing to show off about how great he is either. Because this is held in the garden of the king's palace, it says at the close of verse number 5. And they celebrated. Verses 6, 7, and 8 just tell us about how luxurious the life was in the palace. Now, you know, it wasn't luxurious for everybody. But at least for these 7 days, not just the great, but the small, not just the important people, but even the stewards or servants were treated to a little bit of hospitality, perhaps as a reward, perhaps as he's trying to buy their allegiance as well. But King Ahasuerus noticed just a few of these things, that in the garden of the king's palace, verse 6 says there were white, green, and blue hangings, these wonderful, beautiful tapestries. There is really no other place in the Bible that brags about the beauty like this, except for where God's Word brags about the beauty of the tabernacle or temple. So this is obviously quite a show. And this tells us, just as a side note, this tells us that whoever the human author is has an intimate knowledge of what's going on behind the scenes, right? That they know the color of the tapestry on the walls and the hangings and the marble and mother of pearl and all of this stuff. So whoever the human author is intimately aware of the palace, what it looked like. But it says in verse 6, there were these beautiful linens were fastened with cords of fine linen and purple, attached to silver rings and pillars of marble, huge stone marble pillars. The beds were of gold and silver, upon a pavement of red and blue and white and black marble, just hugely show off. I mean, just expensive beyond all imagination. I mean, just if you can just think, I tried to relate it to the nicest hotel I've ever been in. You know, we hadn't stayed in a lot of nice places, but we've been to a few of them. And one of the places that we stayed in Israel, 5-star hotel that we stayed in Israel, just a beautiful place. But it wasn't anything compared to what this was, I promise you that. When you have unlimited finances, you know how he has unlimited finances? Because he takes over entire swaths of people and takes all their money from them. And then he forces taxes on them. I mean, they have just an incredible bankroll, just beyond imagination. So much so that they have enough gold that they're sleeping in golden beds and silver beds, and they're drinking out of golden vessels, golden pitchers, golden cups. Look what it says in verse number 7, and they gave them drink in vessels of gold. And not just were they vessels of gold, the vessels being diverse one from another, they didn't even look alike. It's not like they had some kind of big press down there where they were pouring gold in and pressing these gold vessels out, that'd be pretty impressive in and of itself. But more than that, these are all handcrafted, and each one is unique and different, but made of gold. That tells you something about the wealth that they had. You know, and I want to be careful because as we present these things, sometimes our old flesh is, man, you know, that'd be nice. You know, being able to live in, I grew up, we'd call it highfalutin. Highfalutin. To live in a highfalutin. I don't even know what that word means. Nobody knows, but that's what we called it. Living up there were the lifestyles of the rich and famous. Beautiful marble this and gold that and fine linen and everything the eye could imagine or the wicked eye could conceive of, any of this, and you could, and our old nature delights in that. But we have got to remind ourselves that none of that helped King Ahasuerus when he needed it. None of that pomp, none of that riches, none of that golden vessels, none of those things meant a thing to him at the hour of death. I promise you that. One of the writers said, it's amazing how we read these things and our old flesh can become somewhat envious. Our flesh can read this and think, man, wouldn't it be nice? And even today we live in a world that so materialistic that makes so much of the trivial. There are men who will get out here and on a field or on a court tonight who will make millions upon millions of dollars because they can throw or dribble a little round ball. We maximize the trivial. We just become materialistic, and it's always been that way, and it'll be that way until the Lord changes our hearts. But rather than looking at them, you say, with any measure of envy, you look at what an extravagant waste all that is. I mean, what an extravagant waste it all is. Does it matter whether or not you're drinking out of wood or stone or gold, as long as you've got something to drink? Does it matter whether or not your bed that you sleep on at night? I don't know about you. I probably wouldn't care about no bed made out of gold anyway. But what difference? As long as you got a place to sleep at night? We maximize, we make too much of the material things and the trivial things. What matters is whether or not you got peace with God or not. But anyway, they're drinking this 7 day. After this 180-day, there's a 7 day shebang, this party, if you will. They're drinking out of golden vessels, but notice also verse 7 says they're drinking royal wine in abundance. Now, you may run right past that, not paying attention to it, and it's understandable, but let me just sum up to you some of what is being said here. They weren't drinking the cheap stuff. They were drinking the royal wine. Now, we're probably pretty far removed from this. Most of us are. But you remember in the New Testament when Christ turned the water into wine? Man who's running the ceremony, the wedding, said, where did this come from? You know, everybody always puts out the good wine and people get wasted. Then they bring out the poor wine. I'm sure you know the story I'm trying to get to. But in this case, they're drinking the royal wine, the high-dollar stuff. This ain't down off the cheap brand. They're drinking the high-dollar stuff, the royal wine. For people who are not VIPs, who are not governors and princes and nobles, that's a pretty big deal. And not just that. Verse 8 says, in close of verse 7, it was in abundance according to the state or the law or rule of the king. And verse 8 says the only rule was you drink all you want to. I mean, that's really what verse 8 is saying. Drink to your heart's content. We can't fully relate to this, but if you're a steward in Shushan the palace and your normal job is something menial, you know, it's your job to sweep the floor, carry out trash, whatever it is, but after 180 days of looking after dignitaries and all these people of pomp and prominence, now the king throws you a party, and not only does he throw you a party, but he lets you drink royal wine, and not only royal wine, but he tells you to drink all you want to. It'll curry some favor with you for the king. And I believe that's some of why he was doing this. Verse 8 says, the drinking was according to the law. None did compel, for so the king had appointed to all officers of the house that they should do according to every man's pleasure. In other words, drink all you want. There's no limit. Not just the cheap stuff, but drink all you want. And not only is this going on, not only is King Ahasuerus throwing this party, but at the same time, verse 9 tells us that Vashti, the queen, also made a feast for the women in the royal house which belonged to King Ahasuerus. So this begins, and this, according to the handout that I've given you, this begins to introduce us, verse 9, 10, to the trouble in the palace. And that's really what I want to title this evening. I'm way late in giving you a title, but trouble in the palace. So far, things are clicking right along. You know, you don't see any trouble in the palace. It seems like things are great. The king has all this power. He's getting ready to go off to war. He's drumming up favor with prince and pauper. He's getting people lined up, everybody in their position. And you have to understand, you know, you got to put it in this context. It was always a battle for power, a struggle for leadership. In fact, this king, King Ahasuerus, had to wrestle control away from his brother to seize control of the Medo-Persian Empire. And so he is buying favor from everybody, from the poor all the way to the rich, from those who have power, even to those who fill his wine cup. He's currying favor with everybody. And it may seem like the king has everything in control. But guess what? And no matter how much power you think you have, he didn't have quite as much control as he think he did. There's trouble in the palace. Vashti the queen has thrown a party for her people, the women in the royal house. But in verse 10 says, on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine. Wine is a mocker. Strong drink is raging, and whosoever is deceived thereby is not wise. Proverbs 20, verse 1. Wine is a mocker. Strong drink is raging. Whoever is deceived thereby, King Ahasuerus, who is deceived thereby, is not wise. So the king, on the seventh day, when his heart was merry with wine, that's a nice way of saying he was loaded. He was drunk. This wasn't just a little buzz he had going. He was drunk. When he was merry with wine, he commanded seven of the eunuchs, or seven of the chamberlains, to go get the queen. Now, I'm not going to read their names again in verse number 10, but he commanded them, verse 11, to bring Vashti the queen before the king with the crown royal, to show the people and princes her beauty, for she was fair to look on. There's a word we used again, if I may pull out a little southern vernacular. He sent those seven eunuchs to go fetch his wife, to go get her and to bring her, to show the people and the princes her beauty. This is the world's most powerful man who had riches beyond imagination, vast armies at his disposal, but he could not control his wife. Right? But the queen refused to come. Verse 12. He wants to show her off. Now, I'm going to try to be careful, but plain. And he wants to show her off as one more of his trophies. A living trophy to his glory and power. He's lit up. He's drunk. He's been showing everything else off in the whole palace. He gets this bright idea, I'm going to show everybody how good looking a wife I got. So he sends these men to go get her. And he wants to, verse 11, he wants to show the people and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to look on. She was a good-looking woman. And he wants to show her off as just one more piece of his own property. Look at how great I've got it. How wonderful my life. Look at the greatness of my kingdom. But the queen refused. We'll get into next week what happens because of that. We're not going to get into it tonight. But it really doesn't make any difference just how powerful he thinks he is. He couldn't control his own wife. Now, some of you may get the idea that I'm going to get myself in trouble tonight, but I certainly am not. She refuses to come. She won't listen. Now, most of us have been taught, and maybe rightly so, that it was the king's intention to show her off in a very public way what should only be seen very privately. I hope this does not come across as too lewd, but a lot of people have said and suggested that the king wanted her to come wearing the crown royal and nothing else. Now, maybe that's true, but we can't know for sure. And I want to be careful that we don't make more decisions than the text does. Now, we know that he was drunk and that wine is a mocker and he was deceived by it and he wants to show her off and her beauty. But whether or not, and that's what I was taught for many years and what I read after some of the commentators would say that he wanted her to come and do some seductive dance in front of all the princes and others. Maybe so. Maybe so, but we don't know for sure. All we know is that this queen's refused to come. Now listen, poor Vashti, and I read some about who the historians think Vashti was. I want to say Vashti or Vashti. I read some about what some of these old historians think she was, and don't feel sorry for her like she's some kind of super saint. Because if what I read about her is true, she's just as rotten as King Ahasuerus was. But she has been condemned by many commentaries as an unsubmissive wife. See, she should have listened to her husband. She's been, poor old Vashti, been beat up by some men by saying, see, that's what happens when you don't listen to your husband. You get kicked out of the house. And then there are others who want to praise her for her virtuousness, but for her morality by refusing to come and show off in front of the king and all of his drunken friends. The truth about it is we don't really know for sure what her reasons for refusing were. Some suggested that she was very pregnant and didn't want to come forward in front of the king because she was pregnant. Maybe so. Maybe he did want to parade her around unclothed. Maybe they got into an argument and she was just putting her foot down. Maybe she didn't like the king when he was drunk. Maybe she didn't want to listen to him because she's just being stubborn. We don't know. All we know is that she said, no, I'm not going to come. And this is why I'm saying all this. Rather than beginning the story with Esther or Mordecai, the author says, let me tell you about this powerful, rich king and his vast empire. And then let me tell you about this stubborn woman that refused to listen to him. And God used that to introduce us to Esther. It was his pride, her stubbornness, that opened the door for Esther to step onto the scene. The author is simply setting the stage for what is to come. Close of verse number 12, and I'm going to quit right here, but the close of verse number 12 says, therefore the king was not just mad, but very mad. And his anger burned in him. Just stop and think how embarrassing it must have been for him to send orders for his queen, and she refused to come. He's sitting there on his royal throne, barking out orders, people bowing before him. Says, bring my wife so that we may see her beauty. And this leader of the known world can't even govern his own house. It would have been hugely embarrassing to him. And he gets angry about it. If there's any New Testament application to be found, it is this. Our King, as I mentioned, is far, far greater than Ahasuerus. Our King is far greater in every way, not just in the wealth and domain, but in His righteousness. Amen. In His purity and in His holiness. And think about this. He'd never treat His bride the way King Ahasuerus treated his bride. I don't want to try to make parallels that don't exist, but I think at the same time when we see the failure of an earthly king and we know how Christ is going to treat His bride, we can make an application there. Now, I know we may not look it, but one of these days we're going to be spotless and without blemish. We may be a little bit rough around the edges right now, but the Lord ain't done working on us yet. And one of these days, we're going to be more fair than Vashti. The text says, all she was fair to look upon. That bride that Christ will present to Himself will be a fair bride, a beautiful bride.